Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Top UN officials, including the Secretary General and the President of the General Assembly, have expressed sadness over the violent scenes on Wednesday involving supporters of President Trump who stormed the US Capitol building. The arrival of the demonstrators temporarily brought a halt to the scheduled confirmation of November's presidential election result. The Secretary General is saddened by the events, a spokesperson for Antonio Guterres said, in response to questions from correspondents, adding that in such circumstances, it is important that political leaders impress on their followers the need to refrain from violence, as well as to respect democratic processes and the rule of law. Volkan Bozkir, president of the UN General Assembly, also voiced his dismay at the scenes on Capitol Hill. In a tweet, Mr. Bozkir said that the US is one of the world's major democracies and that he believed that peace and respect for democratic processes will prevail in our host country at this critical time. Earlier in the day, several thousand protesters marched on the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C., the heart of American democracy and home to the House of Representatives and the Senate, after President Trump and his supporters repeated false claims of election rigging. More than 50 individuals arrested under Hong Kong's new national security law should be released immediately, the U.N. Human Rights Office, OHCHR, said on Thursday. 53 political activists, academics, former legislators, current district councillors and lawyers were arrested on Wednesday, OHCHR said. Spokesperson Liz Throssell noted that the arrests were the latest in a series of detentions over the exercise of fundamental freedoms, including the right to peaceful assembly in Hong Kong. These latest arrests indicate that, as had been feared, the offence of subversion under the national security law is indeed being used to detain individuals for exercising legitimate rights to participate in political and public life, she said. Ms. Throssell stressed that the exercise of the right to take part in public affairs is a fundamental right protected by the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which is incorporated into Hong Kong's basic law. The UN Rights Office and independent experts have repeatedly warned that offences such as subversion under the National Security Law, which was passed in June 2020, are vaguely defined and facilitate abusive or arbitrary implementation. The massacre of civilians in Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, has been condemned strongly by the UN Secretary General, who's called for justice for the victims and their families. At least 25 villagers were reported killed by the Allied Democratic Forces, ADF militia, in the villages of Tingwe, Mwenda and Nzenga, near Beni territory in North Kivu province on Monday. It was reportedly the second mass killing in a week in eastern DRC, where dozens of armed groups continue to roam the vast and resource-rich region. In a statement issued by his spokesperson, Antonio Guterres reiterated his call for a global ceasefire and urged all armed groups to lay down their weapons. He also stressed the determination of the UN peacekeeping mission in the country, MONUSCO, to protect civilians and support efforts to consolidate peace and stability in the country. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, in our Lawyers You'll Like series, we have a special place for attorney and professor Holly McGuigan.
Holly is a criminal defense attorney. You'll not just like her, you'll love her. And her storytelling, like every defense lawyer, is beyond belief.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
We go now to hear National Lawyers Guild leader, attorney Jim Lafferty from Los Angeles, with his guest editorial.
In an article in the New York Times of December 14th appears this thought, quote, "The meeting of the Electoral College is an important moment in American democracy," close quote. In truth, while the meeting of the Electoral College is an important moment, its importance really lies in demonstrating that the United States of America is not a democracy. We too often forget that the founders of the United States did not create a true democracy. Oh, compared to the countries they left behind, America was a more democratic nation. But to call it a democracy is grossly unfair to the very concept of what constitutes a true democracy. And the lack of truly democratic intentions by the founders goes way beyond the Electoral College's role in the election of the president. It includes a constitutional construct where, initially, only property owners could vote, and that while counting black people as only fractional human beings for purposes of apportioning governmental representation, nevertheless, by counting them at all, added to the amount of representation of slave owners in the House of Representatives. We have a constitution that gives every state, no matter the size of its population, two senators. As a result, the 26 least populated states have as many senators as the 24 most populated states, putting a lie to the notion that in America it is one person, one vote. Hell, New York City has a larger population than a couple of dozen states. Of course, the fact that America is not a true democracy goes way beyond the lack of true democratic intent on the part of our founders. There is the matter of gerrymandering, whereby the particular party in control of a state's legislature can draw up federal voting districts so as to ensure the party in power stays in power and has an unequal amount of congressional power. Yet another way of putting a lie to the notion of one person, one vote. Then, too, think of the multitude of our current Jim Crow laws. Laws designed to keep people of color or people not likely to vote for the party in power from voting at all. Think of all the repressive and discriminatory voting ID requirements and the purging of state voter registration lists by the party in power. Prize-winning investigative journalist Greg Palast has found convincing evidence of millions of would-be voters wrongfully erased from voter registration rolls before every major election, including the one that just took place. Think of the role money plays in deciding who wins elections. Campaign funds are unlimited under the Supreme Court's ruling in the Citizens United case, and more often than not, the candidate with the biggest campaign chest wins the election. Elective office, in turn, opens doors to all sorts of ways for elected officials to earn millions of dollars for their own personal campaign treasuries. No wonder, then, that over 50% of the members of the U.S. Congress today are worth at least $1 million, with dozens worth many, many millions more. Given that this is, and always has been, a capitalist nation, it only follows naturally that it would not be a true democracy. It follows naturally that, as Naomi Klein has written, America is not a democracy. It is instead a quote-unquote corporate oligarchy. And if the politician that a member of the corporate oligarchy buys does not perform as promised, they sell that politician's place in Congress to somebody else who will. The fact that our public school system keeps teaching our children that they live in a democracy represents, at a minimum, miseducation and should really be understood to, well, constitute a form of child abuse. The most respected international bodies that each year grade and rate the world's democracies now consider the United States at best a quote-unquote flawed democracy. The VDEM report, an annual report from an international agency that tracks democracies around the world, says of the United States, and I quote, "The United States is the only country in the Western world and in North America suffering from substantial autocratization." And their reasoning for this designation went far beyond the fact of the Trump presidency. 80% of countries in this status, by the way, fail to change before full autocracy takes hold of the countries. So we have been warned. And now the real question is, will we heed the warning? I have no illusions. It will be a long and difficult struggle. But what cause worthy of great struggle is not? We've got to be willing to accept that only profound revolutionary change in our nation's governance and economic system will be the answer. We must better organize and unify the young of our nation, a majority of which already believe socialism is a better economic system for America than capitalism. Organize and unify those young Americans with that majority of a diehard members of the Democratic Party who also believe socialism is the best way forward. Our nation's changing demographic reality is on our side. Other peoples and other nations have struggled and turned their countries into true democracy. So history itself is on our side. A future of economic justice can be ours, but only if we organize and fight like hell for it.
In our Lawyers You'll Like series, we're joined now by Holly McGuigan, a professor of clinical law at New York University School of Law. Holly teaches at the Comparative Criminal Justice Clinic at NYU. She serves on the boards of directors at the National Clearinghouse for the Defense of Battered Women and the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. Holly is a past co-president of the Society of American Law Teachers, SALT, which is the largest membership organization of law professors in the United States. She's about to be honored by SALT in January as a great law teacher. Holly, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Holly, you had a kind of a career switch because I think you were studying medieval literature, English literature, and then wound up in law school. Tell us about that.
Well, I was doing medieval history, actually, and I was at Berkeley, and it was 1967, and Oakland stopped the draft. Well, and I was still interested in medieval history, but I got very interested in the anti-war politics. I'd been interested in anti-racism politics before, but I always thought I could do my main intellectual love and my political love simultaneously. They didn't have to be the same. And I hated lawyers. I really hated lawyers. They were boring. They talked about themselves all the time. They only had stories about their cases and how great they were. And they would never post bail when people got arrested. So I had, like, very little use for lawyers. But I went to a meeting. I had moved to Santa Cruz from Berkeley. And I was at a meeting planning the People's Park demonstrations in 68 in California. And this guy takes the microphone and starts reading, and there's another guy in the back of the room who starts ululating. It's like right out of Battle of Algiers. It's unbelievable.
What's ululating mean? That's a big word for someone
like
me.
It's like making a sound that I can't make, but it's like making a kind of keening, howling, keening, wonderful sound. And he came running up to the mic and grabbed the mic and said, every time a suit tries to read you something, stop them. There's all these surveillance cameras here.
What's a suit? He's like got, a lawyer wearing
like
a suit?
Like a person wearing a suit. and he says, there's all these surveillance cameras. They all know you're here. This means, this. What he's reading is a John and Jane Doe injunction against the march on People's Park. They've got cameras. They can every one of you is in criminal contempt if you now do the march, if you let him finish reading the injunction. Now, just don't ever let anybody. Just shriek, yell, do whatever sound you want to make. I thought that was so cool. That was the best. The most useful thing I'd ever seen a lawyer do in my life. So I went home. My fiancé was applying to law schools, despite my complaints. You're much too nice a person to go to law school. You shouldn't go to law school. And I was applying to history PhD programs. So I went home and I said, give me every application you haven't filled out. And I took it to a copy shop and I made copies. And so I applied to every law school whose application he hadn't finished. We were right up against the deadline.
Great way to select a law school.
It's as good as any, you know.
Or a profession, for that matter.
Worked out well.
Which one accepted you?
We decided to go to the school that accepted us both and gave me the most money, because his family had money, but mine didn't. And that was the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, which is where I stayed then for 17 years.
Well, let's talk about that, because you had the one of the preeminent constitutional and criminal defense law firms, Carey's, Rudofsky, and McGuigan in Philadelphia, and you were there during a time when Frank Rizzo was the police chief, and then the mayor, and we'll talk about Frank also. But I want to talk to you about your law practice and the kind of cases that you took there and how you developed into a criminal defense lawyer and a constitutional lawyer, because that leads right into your then becoming a teacher. But let's talk about the old days in Philly. How'd you start out?
I love that. Well, first, I started out as a public defender. I loved being a public defender. It was the beginning and end of everything I had hoped it would be. It was just great. And that's where I met David Radofsky and David Carey's. They were then Defenders when I was a student. And after they went out on their own, they invited me to join them. And I kept putting it off because I loved being a Defender so much. I knew that working with them would be fabulous. I mean, there's no question. I just kept deferring it till finally they said, you know what, we can't wait any longer. We have to, like, go someplace else. What?
But let me ask you, I understand you love being a public defender, but I've had other friends who've been public defenders. And, you know, it's not an exactly wonderful job in certain ways because the people you meet have been so oppressed by the system and your chances of giving them anything meaningful is very hard. I mean, I've had friends who just said, I can't stand being in here. I can't go into the pens anymore with 50, you know, African-Americans or Latinos that are just being harassed by this society. So how did you psychologically, I mean, I just, you know.
I don't know the answer to that, except that, first of all, in Philadelphia, there was much more actual litigation, not just motion litigation. Mm. There's a lot of that here in New York City, but actual trials, lots of trials. So you really had a shot at getting somebody off. And you had a sense, there was an analysis, that people were doing life on the installment plan and that what you needed was to do what you could to kick them loose any particular time. And your clients understood that. There were limits to what you could do. The system wasn't the least bit fair. But people really appreciated the fact that there were lawyers at the Defender Association who were willing to give everything they had to get them out. And so it inspired you, you know what I mean? There was never a morning you got up and thought, why am I doing this, you know? And it was,
definitely,
in many ways, a difficult office to work in because instead of representing a client from beginning to end, which you didn't get to do until it was a major case, for the life on the installment plan cases, you know, the ordinary misdemeanors and low-level felonies, it was what's called vertical representation. You represented a room. But even so, you got to know people. So when you went to the jail, there were people who called your name and you knew their names. And it was, you know, it was a community in its own odd way. And it was very difficult for me to leave it. I found it very painful to leave.
Did you have any... How many years were you there, Holly?
I was there 3 years.
So you didn't really get to the highest level death penalty cases, right?
And there weren't then. There was no death penalty in Pennsylvania then. So I got to
the Quaker state, Michael.
Right.
No,
and
there is now.
Yes, right. There is now, for sure. But you moved quite quickly if you worked hard in that office. So I was doing major felonies within a couple years. Yeah.
Let's... going to private practice now.
Okay.
You go in with Carey's and Radofsky, who I sat next to in law school because I'm Smith and he's R, and that's how it was arranged at NYU. But anyway, he goes to Philly. You wind up in Philly. They invite you to join the firm. It was one of those famous movement firms. Talk about what the three of you did.
Well, we did actually a lot of different things. David Carey's was very focused on constitutional litigation and government misconduct. Not to say he didn't do criminal stuff. He did the Camden 28, which was a big draft-resisting case in the late 70s. And Dave Carey's did a lot of police misconduct and some criminal defense. And my interest was more in the criminal defense. I liked that part better. I did police misconduct because the legal worker in that office, Jaima Abdu, who then came to New York and was office staff for the National Office of the National Lawyers Guild. Jaima was really a brilliant litigator, and she just gave me my marching orders and told me what to do, and so I did what she said. So it was a mix of things, and I did a lot of grand jury stuff in that time.
But that was political, right?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of cases, like...
Like the Patty Hearst grand jury was one of the first ones. It's where I met Bill Kunstler and Margie Ratner, now Margaret Ratner Kunstler.
Most people won't know what the Patty Hearst case was.
Well, it was. There was a grand jury convened. It met all over the country, or several of them met, to investigate the alleged transportation of Patty Hearst by the Symbionese Liberation Army from California, where she had been captured to...
captured by the
Symbionese Liberation Army.
It's a great story. It's one of the great stories.
It's one of the great stories. At that time, I was involved with a man who was working for Mo Udall for president. And Mo Udall said something that annoyed me about the SLA. And Paul Tully calls me up and he says, "Let me just understand this. I don't get to come home until Mo goes on the network and says the SLA are my kind of people."
Again, the SLA is Symbionese Liberation Army.
Right.
Patty Hearst was, of course, an heir to the
Hearst fortune. Right.
And she's kidnapped. She's like not necessarily part of anything.
No. Kidnapped because she was a Hearst.
Right.
No, it was nothing she did. Nothing she did. So anyway, so these grand juries were convened, and I got a call from the Center for Constitutional Rights, about which you two know everything there is to know, and I bet your listeners do also. And I got a call just about being emergency counsel if there was a stay requested from a Harrisburg grand jury. And I was very excited because on the phone were Bill Kunstler and Rhonda Copeland and all these people whose names I knew but I didn't know. And they're explaining what they want me to do as if we were in the Second Circuit. It's a very New York thing. You assume the way things work in New York is the way they work everywhere. And that if everybody says that's not how they work, they think you just don't get it. So I was explaining the way the Third Circuit works. And I said, I need more. I need you to send me the papers. I need some reason to say why we have to wait for Bill and Doris and whoever else to get here. Because otherwise they'll just make me argue. Oh, no. I said, trust me, this is the Third Circuit. This is a different place. This is what they do. You file an emergency appeal, an application for a stay. They get a judge who's available. You have to go in. So it was apparently they hung up the phone then and said, we got a live one in Philadelphia. Let's rope her in. So that's how I got involved. And it was fun. We went all over. And we knew ultimately we were going to lose. You always lose. But you can cause a lot of delay and quite a bit of havoc if you're creative and energetic.
Were there witnesses you were representing in front of the grand jury?
Yeah. I represented Jay Weiner, who was then a sports writer who'd been blackballed because of his connection with the sports left. Remember Jack Scott and Nikki Scott in the Mexico Olympics
and the African Americans who raised their
fists.
And they were involved with those people.
Yes.
Right.
So he was supposed to, after being graduated from college, go to local, I won't name it because I'm actually kind of fond of this newspaper, but a local newspaper that then withdrew the job offer. And he was working as a cook, actually not a bad cook at all, in a local vegetarian eatery in Philadelphia. Until the grand jury was over, he did some time. He was at Allenwood. But he got good advice from other clients of mine, so he
refused to testify.
He refused to testify and was held in contempt.
And the issue again was how the kidnapping and transportation.
It was any information about it.
He
wouldn't
that.
Give any information at all about what he may have known about what his friends were up to.
Because they're looking for Patty Hearst everywhere, right?
At this point, they're looking for Patty Hearst or anybody who might have been involved in her kidnapping and transportation. This is after they had firebombed that house in Oakland. I mean, this was after a lot of tragedy. And so he ended up going to prison, but not for all that long, because one of the things you can do is then torture the judge until he lets him out. So we did that, and we got him out. So it could have been worse.
Let's talk about some more cases while you were doing criminal defense law in Philadelphia, because at that time Frank Rizzo was unfortunately around. Talk to us about him and the contention between your firm and his policies.
Well, he was a killer. I mean, there's no question. Under his tenure as commissioner of police and then as mayor, more people died as a result of police actions than before or since. I mean, one of the amazing things was that the next mayor, who was no great shakes, saw the number of deaths decrease by 33% just in the first 6 months of his time. It was a time when police were really green-lighted to do whatever they wanted and told it was the right thing to do. I don't mean to suggest that all the police started out homicidal, What I mean to suggest is this was a situation in which from the top down came the message, if you're a good cop, then you're going to take people out however you think you need to. And he himself was very sporty about it. You know, he liked to go out in a cummerbund in his night clothes with a nightstick stuck in his tuxedo cummerbund and round people up. I mean, and humiliate people. I mean,
yeah, look what he did to the Panthers.
Exactly. I was thinking about his invasion of the Black Panther Party headquarters in Philadelphia and his bringing out everybody who was found in there and forcing them to strip and stand naked on the street in the cold while he walks behind them wielding his nightstick. It was gross. It was horrible. It was really a very, very bad time.
So what did you folks at the law firm do litigation-wise in this situation?
We did a lot of criminal defense, of course, and a lot of litigation against the police tactics, and at all different levels, right? I mean, David and David did a lot of excessive force litigation, a lot of illegal search litigation. I tended to do litigation about people who were targeted more because of who they were, but together we did a lot. And the reality is, in that kind of situation, organizing is absolutely as important as litigating. And it was hard sometimes to keep your eye on the ball, you know what I mean, to remind yourselves that the litigation was one piece of a strategy, that unless people made it clear that they weren't going to tolerate this police violence, a judge's ruling or a jury's decision wasn't going to matter that much. But it's interesting, you get involved in litigation and then you think, oh, this is it, this is the greatest, and people who were normally wearing thuggy clothes and feeling like they were wanted to show how tough they were are coming in little suits, and you say, Michael, what are you doing? He says, my mother's coming. You know? It's like, so it's important. And the lawyers play into that a lot. I mean, you really have to keep being mindful of the fact that you cannot ask people to take time away from organizing for litigation, that the litigation has to be just part of the whole strategy.
Now, did you develop any kind of specialty while you were working with Carrie Zrodowski and McGuigan?
Kind of by accident, I did, in a way. By the time we'd worked together for several years, I thought I knew about race and class bias in the courtroom as much as a white woman who was middle class could know. And then I got assigned to represent a woman who was accused of killing her abusive boyfriend. And I was just blown away by what happens when you add hatred of women to hatred of black people and hatred of poor people. It stunned me. It absolutely stunned me. I just had no idea. So, I mean, yes, I had some specialties before that. You know what I mean? I did some grand jury stuff, and I represented a lot of gay groups who were being harassed in various parts of the city. But this thing just stunned me. And I called the judge who assigned me to this homicide to say, why me? Why did you assign me to this? And he said, oh, you just came up next, you know. It was like Philadelphia was very corrupt at that time, so he was one of the few judges who didn't demand money to be on the list to get a... Oh, I'm telling you, judges would go by me in the hall and say, oh, McGuigan, you didn't give me anything this Christmas, not even one lousy bottle. You're not getting any assignments.
Wow.
Oh, yeah,
amazing.
Judges would do things like they'd open the drawer in their chambers, and there'd be... you know, wads of bills, and they'd let you know what they wanted. Oh, I had one time I was litigating a motion to suppress, and the judge said, it's just about time for the lunch and recess. I bet between now and 2:15, you and your client will come up with 200 reasons why I should rule in his favor.
Oh, my gosh.
I know.
that guy's cheap.
Stunning, right? So, well, it was a long time ago. And if you get 200 from everybody,
Right.
You see what I mean? It's not that cheap.
That's amazing.
And 200 is within reach for a lot of people.
Those are amazing stories.
It was an incredible time. About the specialty.
Not
all right.
Your specialty in bribing judges, but your specialty
not.
In judges
actually,
in law.
I was famous for not bribing them. So this guy gave me this case because I didn't bribe anybody. I was like known for... So he assigned me this case for no particular reason, and I went... This was the first time, to my knowledge, I now realize I had represented a lot of women who'd been victimized by intimate partner violence. I just didn't recognize, I didn't know, you know, I just didn't know. But this was the first time that I was aware that that was what was going on. So I went to this restaurant where what happened was he attacked her in a restaurant and pushed her back through the tables. She fell out of her shoes. She was knocking things off the tables as she went by, asking people for help. This is what she tells me, crying out for people to help her because he's strangling her and she can barely breathe. And they get to the back of the restaurant where there's a carving table, and she picked up a knife and stabbed him in the arm, meaning to get him just in the arm to make him stop. But because of the knife was very sharp. They were in a restaurant. And because of a birth defect or a birth, you know, anomaly, his heart was very close to the chest of his wall. It was far, so the knife pierced his heart and he died instantly on the spot. So I hire an investigator and I say, go to this place, it's around the same time, and see if there are any witnesses, because it's a neighborhood place and maybe there are people who go there every evening for an early dinner. And the investigator calls me and says, you have to come here. I go, I do not have to come here. I'm in court tomorrow. Excuse me, Joe. You're the expert investigator, and I'm the litigant. I do not. Trust me. You have to stop whatever you're doing, and you have to come here. So I went there, and there were all these people in the restaurant, including a couple guys sitting at the bar. And Joe turns to them and says, tell her what you just told me. So they all look around, and one guy kind of collects himself and says, basically what she had said to me. He describes the scene. It starts out, remember cigarette machines? It starts out by the cigarette machine just inside the door. And he's saying, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to kill you. And she's asking for help, and nobody's helping. And,
wow.
And I say to him, why didn't you help her? And he says, we feel so bad about it now. But at the time, we didn't know they weren't married.
What?
So I thought, okay, what? This is a whole new world.
Right. It would have been wrong.
If they'd been married, it would have been okay.
Right. Right. So I called the Women's Self-Defense Project, and I said, I really need help. I don't have any idea how to pick a jury. It's like, how do you pick a jury in a case? I mean, I'm used to picking juries in street crimes and the odd federal case, but it's mainly... where the focus is on a person for reasons that are hideous, not because of reasons of anything they actually did. I have no idea. So it changed everything for me. So I developed something of a specialty in women who kill men. There is that. Although I should hasten to say that some of my best friends are men.
I appreciate that. You married one of ours.
And, I'm saying that my own personal husband is a very nice man. Right?
Although Michael did just pull his chair 2 feet farther from
he
Holly.
Did.
Now, what year was this? Because this is the very beginning of really the establishment of this...
of the notion that women could claim self-defense and be reasonable.
Mid-'80s, earlier?
No, late 70s.
Late 70s,
okay. It was... Liz Schneider was doing her work then in New York.
Right,
the Women's
Self-Defense
Project,
Rights,
right at the Center for Constitutional Rights, was doing their work. So it was... this started in the late 70s. And then... in the early 80s, a group in Philadelphia called Women Against Abuse began working, and they did advocacy for battered women accused of crime, and it made a huge difference. It meant that we could collaborate with people who were really knowledgeable about the dynamics of intimate partner violence and about who to use as expert witnesses if you decided to use an expert witness, and about how to get in touch with them and what to do. It made a huge, huge difference.
Well, a remarkable experience. There's a number of other experiences while you were a criminal defense lawyer, but one that I know you mentioned to us was your argument in the Supreme Court.
Right.
But why don't you talk about that?
There was an issue running around about a person accused of crime and their right to cross-examine certain statements. And it was a question about the Sixth Amendment and the right to do it. And it was coming up in the Ninth Circuit, which is California, and in the Third Circuit, which is mainly Pennsylvania, although also Delaware and parts of New Jersey. So we were aware of all the litigation that was going on, and I was trying a case with this guy who was characterized by the newspapers as a rogue ex-cop who taught me a lot, actually. He taught me how to move because he used to arrest what then we called second-story men, you know. And he taught me about how you get a double hefty garbage bag and you tie it with a square knot and you can carry almost anything. Since then, I've never moved any other way. I only move with garbage bags. They're very strong. They're very forgiving. So anyway, this guy was, I had represented him for years. He got in all kinds of entertaining trouble and it was fun, you know, and mainly we won. And David Radofsky and I collaborated in a couple cases. Sometimes they went after him and they would search his house, and then David would sue them for the Fourth Amendment violation and earn enough money to pay our fee, and that just annoyed them so much. So in this case, we lost, and we appealed it to the Third Circuit, but appealed it having made a record that we knew satisfied the standards of the Ninth Circuit and the Third Circuit. Well, arguably that was a tactical error, because then when the government applied for cert, it was
cert being the way.
A petition for certiorari is an application to the Supreme Court to hear an appeal, which they wouldn't hear as of right. And most criminal appeals, you have to petition for certiorari in order to get the Supremes to hear it. So they petitioned, and I say to my friends, we are dead in the water. This is it. They're going to grant cert in our case and not in one of the Ninth Circuit cases, and we are so dead. So by this time, David had stopped doing quite so much litigation. Dave Radofsky had done a lot of, had been doing, being the trainer for the Defender Association. And Dave Carries was moving into teaching. So I had started this other firm with Edmund Tyriac and Julie Shapiro and Leslie Engel to do more litigation. So by the time this case went to the Supreme Court, that was the team. And I said to them, you know what? Once the cert petition was granted, which meant the Supreme Court was going to hear the appeal, it was over. It was totally over. So I said to them, we cannot let this take over our lives. It's true, it's the major leagues. On the other hand, we could write the best brief in history or submit no brief at all. And we're going to have Marshall and Brennan dissenting. We could do the best argument ever or fall down in a dead faint from panic, and we'll have Marshall and Brennan dissent. Let's not forget, this is six troglodytes and three dweebs, and it's just not going to work out for us. Our team is not going to win here. So we tried really hard not to get caught up in it. But it's, you know, there is a mystique about arguing in the Supreme Court. Well, you know, right? It's like a thing. So we ended up putting a whole lot of energy into the brief and a whole lot of energy into the argument. And in the end, do I need to say we had Marshall and Brennan dissenting? There was no choice. But anyway, it was entertaining. It was fun. Kind of exciting. My mother came, and oh, actually, and this particular charge was a charge of manufacturing methamphetamine. So I practiced. I wanted to say to the justices, "Excuse me, Mr. Chief Justice, justices, could we not mention methamphetamine? My mother's here. She thinks I'm a civil rights lawyer."
You see why Holly's a great trial lawyer. I mean, she's one of the best storytellers we've ever had on the show.
And teacher, Michael.
You can just see it. You can see me being on the jury. I just want to hear more from her, right?
So how did you get from doing this kind of mischief to teaching? Because you went from Philadelphia to New York.
I did. Well, it turned out there were several reasons. One was the battered women's cases I was working on were quite consuming, because people then didn't know very much about how to try these cases. the judges expected you to plead insanity or just to plead guilty. I mean, reasonable doubt was a consideration at sentencing, not at trial. You know what I mean? It was one of the... So working with trial teams... And there were cases that really did require teams. There was no question. So I found that I was spending a lot of time working with trial teams on other cases, trying to help them get up to speed with Women Against Abuse, which is a group that turned into or became... the National Clearinghouse for the Defense of Battered Women, the only national group that provides backup for these cases. So part of it was wanting to have a situation where I could do that work without exhausting myself and all our resources, because you don't get paid to do that kind of stuff. And we did need to make a little bit of money. We never made very much money. Most of the best criminal defense lawyers I know never made very much money. But you do need some. You know, you need to pay for the repairs on the copy machine, and you need to pay your rent. And so anyway, that was one reason. Another was that my daughter, who was then 6, would get up in the morning on weekends and come into my bedroom and wake me up and say, "Are witnesses coming over today?" Because my life, once I hadn't started out as a single parent, but once I became a single parent, I felt guilty all the time. Either I was at the prisons and jails and meeting with my clients, or doing investigation and meeting with witnesses, or I was taking care of my daughter. But whichever I was doing, I felt dreadful. So,
your daughter's name is Miranda, and I want to just sidetrack here
about
why. We're not talking about Shakespeare and the Tempest, are we?
No, we're not. No, actually, when I was pregnant, I used to go around City Hall in Philadelphia. I answered ready on every case. Do you have any idea how much fun it is to try a case when you're hugely pregnant? Oh, it was the best. I mean, talk about the jurors wanting to hear more. They couldn't take their eyes off you. All you had to do was move a shoulder, and they were sure you were going into labor. I mean, no chance that any terrible witness would be listened to. You know what I mean? Somebody gets up and says something bad about your client, and you are just moving around in your chair a little bit. Nobody can listen to him at all. Who cares what he says? All right. So I'd walk around answering ready on every case, and people would say, "What are you going to name the baby?" And I'd say Miranda, after Miranda versus Arizona.
Which is the case?
The Fifth Amendment case.
It said you don't have to tell us what it is.
It's the case where the Supreme Court held that the Fifth Amendment due process clause secures your Sixth Amendment right to counsel. The police have to tell you you have a right to a lawyer before they interrogate you if you're in custody. Right.
But, you know, there's another Miranda right. With reference to Carmen Miranda, the exotic dancer, you have a right to wear fruit on your head and dance funny.
As Miranda did many, many Halloweens.
That's funny.
And I'd say, Miranda, unless it's a boy, in which case Gideon, which was the original right to counsel case. A friend of mine took me aside, Linda Bakkeel, actually, who's in the Lawyers Guild and now in Puerto Rico, took me out to dinner and said, "You know, you're wrong to make jokes about the name Miranda, because outside of a small circle of perverts, more people will think of the Tempest than will think of the Fifth Amendment rights of an accused rapist." So I go home and I say that to her father, and Paul says, "Your friends are so weird." First of all, it's your small circle of perverts. And second of all, the character in the Tempest is the most male-identified female you could imagine, right? She gets handed off from her father to a sprite to a boyfriend. I mean, please. All right. So Miranda was sort of a joke, but off the table. Then she was born, and she seemed like a Miranda. So we, you know, before we left the hospital, we debated back and forth, and finally he came in and he said, "I did it." I say, "What did you do?" "She's Miranda McGuigan Tully. That's it. And we can call her something else. We can change it within 90 days. Not long after that, I get a call from a friend who says, "Richie's really in trouble this time. You have to go and represent him at the hearing." I said, "I don't have to go. I've got a baby who's like a week old. I'm on maternity leave. I definitely don't have to go." And she says, "Just go by the newspapers and look who's on the front page." So I went and I looked and I go, "Okay, Richie's really in trouble this time." So I go.
Richie is your rogue cop?
No, Richie's just another guy. Oh, he was a friend of a friend, you know. Had been in trouble several times, and this was really like a serious one. So I go to the courthouse, And as I'm walking into the courthouse, I run into a detective who says, "We arrested Gene so-and-so last night." And I said, "I know, you let him call me. Thanks a lot. You let him call me at 3 in the morning. I'm a nursing mother. What was that?" He goes, "We arrested him, like we always do." And it's true, they always did arrest him. And we say to him, like we always do, "So, Gene, what are you going to do for yourself?" And he wouldn't give us anything. I say, "I know, you let him call." The way it worked was, if he wasn't going to talk, they'd let him call me. But if he already talked, then he wouldn't call me. So it was not like calling me was significant, except to wake me up in the middle of the night. So he says, no, are you going to listen or are you going to talk?" So I said, "Okay, I'll listen." So we arrested Gene the way we always do. We take him into the district the way we always do. And we say to him, like we always do, "Gene, what are you going to do for yourself?" And he says, "What am I going to do for myself? What am I going to do for myself? Do you know who my lawyer is? Do you know what she named her baby?"
That's fabulous.
It was
Holly.
Fabulous. It was seen That's as an great. Act of total solidarity by right. my clients. I mean, every facility I went into after she was born right. had pictures of her up with
I
little bars in front.
This is a great statement.
So we moved to New York, first to CUNY. And I have to say, I'm so grateful to CUNY Law School for giving me that chance. I was a totally untried teacher. I mean, I'd taught trial advocacy as an adjunct, but I had never been a full-time teacher. And they took me on, and it was great. And the students were great, and my colleagues were great, and I realized this is what I want to do. But I missed court. And in those years, this was 1986, 87, and CUNY didn't yet have a criminal defense clinic. And so I moved to NYU. I didn't need to be trying the cases, but I wanted to be in court. I wanted to be in the presence of that conflict between the authorities and regular people and see what could be done. So I went to NYU, where I taught in the criminal defense clinic for many years, had a wonderful time. You have, to see students react to the great stories that their clients have is just amazing, because it's all about loving people, right? I mean, it's all about being fascinated by the stories. And people accused of crime get into such wonderful pickles. And it's just Miranda likes to tell a story about a client who's, in New York, the prosecutors are required at arraignment, the first appearance before a judge, to give you what's called statement notice. They have to tell you what statements they intend to use against your client at trial. They have a certain number of days to do it. Usually they do it at the arraignment. And one client's statement notice was, "What can I say? I was in the wrong place at the wrong time doing the wrong thing." It's Miranda's favorite. I mean, when I told her that story, it was like, okay, that's it. Nobody's ever going to get better than that. That was the best.
We're speaking with law professor Holly McGuigan, who is currently on leave, about her career as one of our lawyers you'll like.
Holly, there's been something I've been meaning to ask you about. You know, I live in the Village also, and I live near NYU. In fact, I actually taught there for a year. And I remember there was a chicken place called Pluck U. It's right across from the law school. And I know there's some stories that you have about Pluck U.
Well, besides the fact that they have the best wings ever, I must say, my godson, who lives in Georgia, visited, and now all he wants for Christmas is Pluck U sauce, since I'm flying down and they don't ship. Anyway, but that's really not related to the teaching so much. The teaching part is, a student was representing a guy who was accused of stealing bikes. Now, this guy, as it turned out, was always accused of stealing bikes. I mean, I ran into him years later in the courthouse, and I say, "Hi, Mr. So-and-so, how are you?" He goes, "I'm okay." I go, "What brings you here?" He says, "Bikes, Holly, it's always bikes." Anyway, he was accused of stealing a bike, and then he would work off the books and deliver food for various people, and he was very good as a food deliverer. You know, he could find any place.
Well, he could use a bike to get there,
and
right?
And he needed a bike, yeah. I mean, what are you talking? We're talking here. And he never actually took it home. He always left it someplace where it could be found. Routinely, he left it right back where he found it, but by then, somebody had gotten cranky. Anyway, so we had a student who was representing him. This is the first time we represented him. And the student comes out, and he says that the night manager, Michael, will vouch for the fact that he worked for them, so it would be employment, we didn't decide to tell the judge the other part about the necessity of the bike. We decided to go with a not guilty on the bike stealing part.
This is the employment manager at Pluck U?
Yes.
Oh, that's where Pluck U comes
in. Where Pluck U comes
in. This guy did deliveries for Pluck U.
Yeah. Okay. And so he says, so the student says, so Michael, he says Michael will verify it, even though it was off the books. I go, terrific. So call him right now. 212-979-2HOT. And it was hard to know who was more appalled, the student that I had the number memorized or me that I had disclosed that was my go-to food for me and my daughter. They don't have a lot of broccoli at Pluck U. But anyway, so that was Pluck U. That was every so often when you're under a bit of stress, you disclose.
I've never been
things.
To Pluck U. It's still there, right?
Why would you ever go to Pluck U? They deliver it to you, and it's delicious.
But I've never had the wings.
Oh, the wings are fabulous. They're the best wings.
I
mean, you have to go to Buffalo for the greatest wings. But actually, there are also great wings in the Finger Lakes District. They're very competitive with Buffalo. But Pluck U, if you're going to be in the New York City area, it's Pluck U.
turning our attention now to teaching rather than eating.
Yeah.
Talk to us about... Well, that's true. Both, really. Let's talk about your experience practicing law and then what you brought into the classroom. Because I can tell you that having a teacher like you would have been a great thing for me. Most of my teachers never knew how to practice law. They were just good law students.
Right. Now, I think it's true. A lot of teachers in law school who are terrific at theory haven't ever practiced, and they don't accept that they're teaching in a trade school, right? You're teaching somebody how to do something that matters hugely, but it's not necessarily a PhD program. And a lot of people really think of it in that. A lot of people who have the job of teaching at law schools. Now, CUNY doesn't do that. CUNY's professors are people who've practiced. And a lot of people at NYU have practiced. But you're right that the students really appreciate the fact that you've practiced, because you can talk about how things work and don't work. You can talk about how fact-specific the implementation of every legal principle is. I mean, if facts are slightly different, then the outcome is going to be affected, even though the principle stays the same. In a clinic, of course, practice is key. You couldn't. It's hard to imagine how you could teach a clinic and supervise student practice if you hadn't yourself gone through the highs and the lows, and it was interesting teaching students how to cope with panic, because I don't know a criminal defense lawyer who hasn't panicked. You always panic. It strikes me actually that you cannot do the job if you don't go from anybody could win this case. Your parrot Charlie could win this case. Anybody could win this case. To them thinking, this case cannot be won.
Right.
Certainly not by me. I am in the slough of despond now. There's no way this case is going to be won. To climbing out of that valley of fear of horrible catastrophe. And then thinking, okay, there's pieces of work to do. We can do it. And I think for students to have somebody who doesn't think that the panic is bad, who sees the panic as something that motivates you, who understands it is a human response to having responsibility for another person. It makes total sense
Beautiful.
To me. It seems to me if you don't have it, you're not feeling everything you ought to be feeling.
Well, that's a remarkably good statement, Holly. I really appreciate it.
You got active in the Society of American Law Teachers, and I want to talk about that because it's a wonderful organization. In fact, they're honoring you as a great teacher come January. But let's talk about SALT and what you did and what SALT tries to do. I only wish that there was a SALT around when we were in law school, but there's one now. Let's talk
there's
to us about what
now.
SALT does.
And when I started teaching, not so much when I was at CUNY, but once I got to NYU and started going to conferences, because it took me a year to just kind of get my feet under me for teaching, and it took me a while to realize that there were conferences where I could learn things. But I was used to the National Lawyers Guild and the National Conference of Black Lawyers and La Raza and the Women in Law Conference, and I kept going to these conferences and thinking, where are the regular people? There's no regular people here. And What's that? I know what that is. That's my phone. That's Lucille, B.B. King.
That's okay. Good.
Okay. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Don't be sorry. We like hearing B.B. King. It'll be over in a second.
Anyway, so where are the regular people? You know, the people who swear and who get tired and cranky and every so often hate their students and just, you know what I mean? Those people, the regular people. Because everybody else was just, the students seemed kind of irrelevant at a lot of these conferences. It was about scholarship and teaching at a certain level. And then I went to my first SALT conference, and it was all regular people. And what SALT is about, Hazel Weiser, who's a stalwart of SALT and a former executive director, sums it up this way. SALT is about who gets into law school, what they learn, and who teaches them. And it's about access to justice, and it's about relating to law school as a place where you train people to do social justice. And so SALT's focus is on students and teaching. And it's not that SALT members don't care about scholarship, because scholarship can often make a huge difference. But the teaching part is key to them, and that's so refreshing. And that was probably in 1988 or 89 that I went to my first SALT conference, and I never looked back. I mean, I've been going to SALT teaching conferences ever since, and I've been a member of the board of directors of SALT, and I'm a past co-president of SALT. I mean, SALT has meant a huge amount in my life since I've been a teacher. It's actually been a defining institution for me.
So now, as Michael said, you're getting the Best Teaching Award from the organization that actually does, that's what
it
it's about.
Does teaching, yes, it's a great honor. I'm very pleased and happy. You know, it's like, I keep saying, you know, it's like one of those things you want to say, I don't deserve it, I don't deserve it. And it's like, I keep saying that, but then I think, but wait, then they'll realize I don't actually deserve it. I should keep quiet about it. I'll keep it.
I mean, I think this has been an extraordinary interview for me, and I think it will be for everybody who hears it. And so I hesitate to ask you, because you've already said it, what you would recommend to people about becoming lawyers. And of course, we're going way down in the number of lawyers that are applying to law school, or people are applying to law school.
Well, it's now since 1975.
Right, what you said is really about putting yourself really in some way between the authorities and the state mm-hmm. and regular people. But is there any last thing in your thoughts about this, Holly?
I think you have to love gossip and love stories and love hearing stories and love hearing them more than once and figuring out how to tell that story, how to enable the person to tell her or his own story when he or she is able. Not everybody accused of crime is able to withstand the stress and actually tell it. But that's the main thing. And then you need to love codes. A lot of people who like law like crossword puzzles because they like filling in the blanks. A lot of people, as it turns out, who like law like medieval history, because a lot of it is about parsing little bits of information to try to see what the whole story is and tease it out. But I think it's really more than anything, it's about liking people and wanting to see what you can do to help them extricate themselves from a problem.
Let's talk about when you were held in contempt.
Well, it was one of my, I was held in contempt several times. But the one case that keeps coming back to me is one where I was held in contempt by the trial level court for not disclosing the whereabouts of a client. And the middle level appellate court reversed the contempt judgment with a great opinion. That's the only one to read, really. Commonwealth versus McGuigan, the appellate court. Then the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, the highest court, overturned that, but actually narrowed the judgment enough that we could live with it. But there were a couple things about it. One is it took so long. The prosecutors really did not care about getting the information. They really just wanted to bother me. It took forever. I mean, they took 3 years to file this and then 4 years to file that. Oh, it was ridiculous. They just wanted to keep it hanging over me. And so there were two terrific things about it. One was at the trial level, the prosecutor says after the judge holds me in contempt, prosecutor says you have to tell her to pay, he assessed a fine of $100 a day. You have to tell her to pay it to the probation department The judge says, I'm not going to do that. Why waste their time? It's just a waste of paperwork. No, you have to, otherwise we can't hold her in an additional contempt for not having paid it. And the judge says, I'm just not going to do that. I'm not going to waste their time. I'm not going to waste my time. Because think about it. She's not going to pay a nickel. Not a dime. Forget $100 a day. She's never going to pay. Right, McGuigan? Not one dime.
So I loved that.
I felt so proud. But then, years later, when I was here in New York, I was subpoenaed to a federal grand jury in connection with a request for disclosure of information about another client. And this was in 87, before computer research was regular, so that a lot of the research you did was in books. And I was in the faculty library late one night, and I realized I must have been banging my head on the desk because I thought I was alone. Another faculty member came over and said, why, what's going on? And I said, well, I've been subpoenaed to a federal grand jury. And every single opinion that I find relies on this, and I point to Commonwealth versus McGuigan. I say, it's so annoying. And he said, isn't that interesting? And it's such an unusual name. Do you think there's any connection? Oh, yeah, I think there's a connection, yeah.
Well, Holly, we so appreciate your being with us. And we call this segment Lawyers You'll Like, but in this case, it's Lawyers You'll Love.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Holly McGuigan, really fabulous.
It was fun. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Holly.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.